Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the JMO Podcast. I'm your host, Taylor Michaels, and our guest this episode, we've got Jason Shakirat back on the show. I've learned a ton from this guy over the years, and it's fun to have him back on. Right after a great finish, you know, I'd have Jason Shakirat on anytime, but it just so happens that we got together right after Lake Huron here, the third stop of the NWT in 2025, where Jason had a top 10, and so we get to talk about that a whole bunch. But we deep dive on multiple topics, and Jason has such a great career and an experience to lean on and offer so much great information here. So let's get into another great one with Jason Shakirat on the JMO Podcast. We're all looking to have the ultimate edge on the water, but how do we get there? When it comes to fishing rods, JT Outdoor Products has you covered. Their technique-specific rods are engineered and tested by tournament professionals to give you the competitive advantage on the tournament trail or the extra edge to the passionate everyday angler. They're hand-built in Farmington, Minnesota. With the highest grade carbon fiber blanks and the finest componentry, JT rods are ultra lightweight, incredibly sensitive, and built for performance. Whether you're after walleye, bass, pike, or panfish, they have every species covered. Their rods deliver precision, durability, and unmatched feel. Don't settle for ordinary. Fish smarter with JT Outdoor Products, where performance meets perfection. Visit them at jtodp.com. That link is in the description of this podcast. Do yourself a favor, check them out today. TKI CNC produces reliable, meticulously crafted marine components for every fishing adventure. Check out a complete listing of products at tkicnc.com. There you'll find lots of things, including the multi-purpose rod holders and their forward sonar pole mounting kits. These product designs specifically maximize your efficiency and reliability in the boat. This is why so many hardcore anglers, including tournament anglers, are turning to TKI to accessorize their boats. For a detailed look or in-depth tutorials, check them out on YouTube, Facebook, or Instagram at TKICNC. Devil's Lake is one of North Dakota's premier outdoor recreational destinations, and to find out more about what the lake and the community of Devil's Lake has to offer, head to devilslakend.com and get all that. We're talking about the lodging and restaurant options and just the lay of the land and everything going on in the community. There's all kinds of stuff all summer long going on in and around the community of Devil's Lake. That link is in the description. Go ahead, man. Give me a little bit of a season recap and some of the memorable stuff that's been happening so far and kind of gotten you where you're at.
Yeah. I mean, the season so far is, I guess the one word to describe it probably be a whirlwind. It's been crazy. Lake Sharp was a tournament that was a struggle for most guys, not catching fish, but just trying to find the bigger ones. And for me, I had a pretty good practice actually down river a ways, and those fish kind of disappeared on me. I thought it was maybe current related, but I came back and checked them when the current came back up, and they still weren't there. And, you know, I did catch fish down there. I just kept throwing them back, and I think on my first initial run through my area, I caught four and threw every one back. And the next thing you know, it's, you know, midday and you're sitting with no fish in the box, and then panic starts setting in because it's your first term of the year. But long story short, I had a terrible finish. I think I was 80th or so, 80 something, and you know, if I'd have kept the fish that I caught, I'd probably been up in the late 50s, 60-ish place, which in the long term is, you know, kind of makes life a little easier. But I just didn't keep the right fish. Things didn't go in. Nothing really went right in that tournament, but shook that off and headed to La Crosse, which to me, La Crosse is, or anywhere on the Mississippi, is my favorite spots to fish. I just love that river and very comfortable out there, and had a great day one. I locked up to pool seven. Caught a 19-incher on my first cast and just proceeded to catch a pile of under 20-inch fish. And knowing I'm going to get an over 20 or two. And, man, it just never happened up there on pool 7. So I locked down to pool 8, ran all the way to the bottom end. First cast on that spot, caught like a 23-incher, lost another big one. and then caught some more unders and finished out my limit there. Day two, I was going to run right back to that same spot on pool eight. And as it turns out, there was nobody there on day one, but rolled in on day two, and there's your tournament leader, Bill Shimoda, sitting on the spot. And I'm like, oh boy. So I talked to Bill about it a little bit, and I gave him all the room he needed. And he said, well, you're good over there, but Danny Plouts is coming down here too. And I knew that Danny had let go a couple of big fish because he already had his two over 20 in the box. And so, yeah, long story short, I kind of gave those guys their space and kind of fished off to the side and caught three 17-inchers and then kept those. And Danny whacked about 15 pounds in 40 minutes. And I got to watch that show and then ran around a little bit, caught one more 18-incher, came back to that original spot. Nobody was there. Bill was gone. Danny was gone. And first cast, lost a big one. Second cast, catch an over. Third cast, catch a 18-incher. And pretty much finished out my limit and finished 17th in that event. So it was a good tournament, got paid. Picked up a bunch of points, and then we rolled into Lake Huron. So just got home from that, and it was a great event. Top 10 that one in sixth, and I did have the second place fish on twice, and some reason they just didn't want to stay pinned for me. I just can't figure it out. Felt the bite, set the hook, fought them for quite a while, chased them around. And they just fall off. It's you just don't know why it happens sometimes, but it's not the first time and it won't be the last.
I'm so curious, like I need clarification about Huron, like what it's really like to fish out there.
Challenging for sure. Extremely clear water. I've seen bottom in 30 feet in a few spots. Fish are very spooky. You have to make extremely long casts, you know, approach them at the right angles. Basically, you know, how I kind of break it down is you got to know where the big migration is in that system. And those fish come up from Saginaw Bay and then they head north out into the big water as the season progresses. So you're trying to figure out, you know, what's the southern boundary of some of these migrating fish and then what's the northern boundary of some of these, because the biggest fish usually migrate first, the females. And they're the ones that get out of Dodge and get away from all the smaller fish first. So you just start breaking down some structure out there in what I call the ocean. And there's plenty of rock, plenty of points, plenty of deep water, shallow water. You gotta just put the pieces together and start covering areas, you know, just miles at a time. And we could kind of tell quickly that there was some fish south early. They were pretty decent quality fish, a lot of 5-pounders. But as the week progressed, those fish got smaller and less numbers. So we started working our way north, and the water temps had increased during the week. So, you know, that's going to dictate a migration pretty quick. And once we got up north further, about 40, 45 miles north of Alpena, we kind of found what we thought was the winning fish, you know, the areas where the biggest females would be, the above average, you know, 6, 5 to 8 pounders. And that's kind of how we broke it down and figured out that system. But it is a challenge. It's tough to get around there. It's super windy, even in a 10 to 15 mile an hour wind. You know, just constantly, you know, these 3-4 foot waves all the time. And it's just a real grind, both mentally and physically, to figure that place out. But it's a challenge, but it's fun at the same time.
Tell me a little bit about what your pre-fish looks like now. I mean, the last time we talked about this might have been 2-3 years ago. This could be like a totally different conversation. Yeah. I'm just sort of curious how you go about your day in, like, say it's day one or two of pre-fishing, and you're just in like total big search mode and you're trying to do all that. Like, tell me a little bit about how you go about it.
Yeah, I kind of, you know, pick an area of the lake that you want to start looking at and you know, Huron, for example, we started south. And just kind of looking at a map and saying, okay, this area has what I think is the most structure, which would probably hold the most fish. So you want to just narrow that down, you know, maybe it's a 2-3 mile area, and just go in there and start picking it apart. I don't necessarily just drop the trolling motor and start looking for them. I'll find a nice rock point to, let's say I want to start shallow, you know, shallow meaning, you know, 10, 15, 18 feet, and just kind of start side imaging some of that rock structure, because there's so much rock there, you know, you have to decipher, okay, where are they going to sit on this rock? And what you're looking for is a different size of rock or a boulder point or, you know, something different. You don't want to be fishing all the same. And once you kind of see a few areas you want to look at, you know, you saw it with side imaging, dropped a couple waypoints on some nice looking boulder points or corners or outside corners or anything that's different. Well, then you just pull up to them, drop the trolling motor, and start looking around, you know, seeing if these fish show themselves. And the thing with Lake Huron is those fish sit pretty tight to the bottom and in those boulders, in the rocks, and they don't really show themselves, but maybe once or twice a day when they come up and really start looking around for feed. But you know, we were doing a lot of blind casting and catching some fish, and then you see those little bite windows occasionally where all of a sudden they start rising up out of the rocks, and then it becomes pretty easy. But, you know, what I do is, you know, start looking shallow, maybe find something that I like, and then maybe start looking out in the mid-depth areas, you know, 20, 22, 24 foot, start looking for some key little boulder piles or something out there. And then just start progressing out deeper, because you're trying to figure out, okay, what depth are these fish holding in? And, you know, covering all three depths, shallow, medium, and deep, and just start putting pieces together as you're picking structure apart. That's kind of how I look at it.
The way we used to talk about, like, pattern fishing or putting together a pattern, mm-hmm. I feel like that conversation has also, like, changed drastically in the tournament world. Again, you know, forward sonar keeps coming back to the conversation, but it's like how often do you find or are you looking for a pattern to try to hold up on tournament day, you know, in terms of a depth, a contour, or a structure, versus just figuring out the area? And then on tournament day, sometimes you catch one in 10 foot, you catch one in 20 foot, you catch one right. Suspended over 40 foot. I'm just sort of curious, like, are you still, like, I mean, you know, do you still find that level of consistency that you can, you know, you can be searching for a pattern?
To a point, you know, what I'm looking for is the area. I want to be in the area that holds the biggest fish. You know, where are they at this given second? And if I can find that, then I can eliminate everything else, knowing I'm in the right area. Then I can start micro adjusting to where these fish are at in that area. Mm-hmm. And that's most important for me. I always consider a tournament a win if I'm in the right area. You know, even if I finish 6th or 17th, mm-hmm. if I'm in the area, I'm happy with whatever happens. I didn't miss the bite. So, you know, once you're in the right area, then that's when the patterns start coming into play. You know, for example, I fished up north on Lake Huron and kind of found that area where the biggest fish were, and then started fishing. The 20-foot depths for me were predominant, what I thought was the best depth where most of the big ones were. But you can then take that area I was in and move over a mile and a half to the next point that looks identical and kind of find the same thing over there. So you're in the area. You get the pattern once you figure out where they're at.
How did you come about figuring out what they were going to bite on or what you were going to fish for a confidence bait on tournament day?
You know, nowadays we carry, I don't know, maybe four presentations in our boat if we're live scoping fish. And one is going to be a jig in plastic. And number two is going to be some type of glide bait, you know, your jig and wrap. I was using the Salmo iGlide a little bit. It's a new bait that I designed for Salmo. Search baits like that. Your standard jig and crawler for the really picky fish. I mean, really, that's about it. If the water's colder, you know, I'll start throwing the hair jigs or the rip and wrap kind of baits, the lipless baits. But this tournament, the water was still pretty warm, and I just primarily had an eye glide tied on. I had a jig for a crawler tied on, and I had a big piece of rubber on a jig head, and it turned out for me the jig and plastic was my go-to. I ended up started the tournament with a jig and crawler on, and the first three bites I got, they picked it up and dropped it almost immediately. And that's not the way you want to start a tournament when you're only getting so many bites a day. So I immediately put that rod away. I grabbed my jig and plastic. The very next fish I saw, threw at it, and it had absolutely inhaled the bait. And I said, yep, this is the deal. And I grabbed another one for my co-angler, and we went to work. And from then on, it was pretty much lights out. But yeah, just gotta figure out what they want on that given day, and don't be afraid to change quickly.
Now, you've kind of already, you know, answered this to some extent, but another thing that I kind of need clarification on, as a fan, like on the outside, you know, I'm seeing the interviews and the social media posts and whatever, and I hear, you know, that a bunch of guys talk about how they fished close to takeoff, and then like Isaac and other people are talking about the huge runs, you know, like a 100-mile run or whatever. Is there just like no fish in between there? Are there, you know, is there something to be looked at? Like, I need a little bit of clarification on just exactly like, cause in my head, I'm just thinking there was, you know, the tournament field was split into two very distinct groups, but like, is that correct or accurate? Like, I need help on that.
Yeah. That's pretty accurate. I mean, so out of Alpena's based at the bottom of Thunder Bay, which is just a giant bay up there in the northern part of Lake Huron. And those fish that were in Thunder Bay were, you know, what I consider resident fish. You know, they're always in Thunder Bay. They just adjust depths according to water temps, and they don't really migrate too much. So those fish, they were getting harassed every day because it's easy, it's close. Guys don't have to make the crazy runs and the big waves. And, yeah, there was a pile of boats that stayed within sight of takeoff trying to catch those resident fish that were, on average, you know, 3 to 5 pounds. Not super easy to catch, but they were pretty abundant. You got denied quite often. You know, if you threw to 8 of them, you might get one to bite. But, those were the guys that stayed close. And then from there was guys both north and south from there. But you got to kind of go out into the lake, out of Thunder Bay, wrap around both corners heading south or north. And then you just start looking at structure. And the structure to the south of Thunder Bay pretty much has what I consider the best structure all the way down that shoreline. There's so many rock points and fingers and humps and deep water, and it's endless. But to me, those were the fish that were getting smaller as the days went on, and there wasn't as many, and they were getting kind of fished for pretty hard, and they become accustomed to the boat sounds and all the pinging going on. So that's, you know, I started heading north and found that there wasn't as many boats up there, but they were the right fish. And then it was just a matter of, you know, dialing in that area. So that's why there was, you know, the guys that played it safe, stayed close, knew they were going to catch 5. They weren't going to be tournament winners, but they were going to be pretty nice and, you know, big enough to cash a check. But this is one that I thought I could gamble on, make the 45-mile run north and try and take a W out of there.
Yeah. So there wasn't a whole lot of boats in and around you. You didn't have to deal with that hardly at all.
No. We had probably 6-7 boats that I know of up there, you know, within eyesight, which is, you know, let's just say 3 miles either direction. So, yeah, it was pretty quiet as far as the tournament goes up where I was, yeah.
So your catch rate or your bite rate, like this is one where I'm trying to get better at. I'm trying to interpret or I'm trying to figure out what works for me. When I interview people or we talk about it, is like, you know, how many fish, you know, playing that numbers game of like being in an area that has this many target fish, and you know, not every one of them's going to bite, but figuring out what they'll bite or what the best, like figuring out what the best balance, what the best bite is, like how I can create a ratio or a batting average of like getting bit the best.
Right.
But, and I feel like more and more I'm starting to realize I need to take that with a large dose of salt when I'm hearing what, you know, you guys are capable of. It's so like, that's like the hardest thing for me to emulate, like on my home body of water. When I go out on, say, Sakakawea, it's not hard to be in and around quite a few big fish. But I feel like if you guys say you're getting bit, you know, 1 in 5 or 1 in 10, and on a good tournament day, you just need to get in front of 200 or 300 fish, I feel like I need to find 1,200 to like match that. but anyways, that's just sort of a side tangent of myself. I guess my question is, how would you describe that on Huron as you were pre-fishing, like thinking you found area that had fish, like how many fish did you feel like you needed, or how many fish did you find that made you, or as you were discovering it, as you were discovering those, like what was going through your head, like how many should I be seeing? And then you hit that point, then your strategy started to come together. But I'm thinking like day 2, 3, or 4 of your pre-fish. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, as far as that goes, you know, LiveScope unveils a lot of those secrets for us to kind of know how many fish are there, but you know, it also becomes a challenge to know if they are buried down in the rocks, belly down, you know, are we just fishing over them and not seeing them? And it's super hard to blind cast up there because it's such big water that it takes you forever to fish anywhere. So, you know, it's always nice when they raise up in a bite window and show themselves, and you find those 6-packs and 8-packs swimming around together. And, you know, you get a real good idea how many fish are in an area as long as you see that. That's the first clue, is to, you know, physically be able to see them to know how many are there. But, you know, yeah, then you, if you do see them, then you just sit down and start fishing for them and put the head down and see how many do I have to cast to catch one. And then, you know, how long does it take to catch 5? And, you know, obviously we're hoping they're the right ones too at the same time. And we're throwing at the biggest marks versus the little guys. And you know, you just kind of put a pattern together of, okay, I fished up there today for 5 hours. I caught 8 fish, you know, saw plenty. They bit really good at 11:30. So that's kind of a bite window at that given time that day. And, you know, you just put it in the old memory bank and say, okay, we've got something up there that's got potential. For us, it was the day before the tournament up in that area way up north, where we sent one of our other guys up there to check it. And I believe he had 10 or 11 bites in about 2.5 hours, which was really good. And it didn't turn out that way in the tournament. They weren't as thick as they were the day before, but there was still plenty of them around to spend the whole day up there and not run around. I only had 6 bites both days. I had 6 bites the first day and landed all 6, and had the good bag, was in 3rd place. And then the second day, it seemed like the numbers were a little less. You're trying to find the schools. Where did they go? Did they go east? Did they go west? They go deeper, they go shallower. It takes time to do that. You know, you just put your head down and start looking. And I had 6 bites the second day and unfortunately only caught 4 of them. And, you know, lost that 2nd place fish a couple times and came back in. So that's kind of how it all played out.
Losing fish, like that's going to sting. But at this point in time in your career, you're still having fun out there, right? I mean, putting together an awesome bite and, you know, day 1, 3rd place, like you had a good time, didn't you?
Yeah, those are the great days. I mean, yeah. Lake Sharp, you know, you look at Lake Sharp, and that's not a way you want to start the year, but it was partly my fault by throwing fish back and no call tournament. You know, we're on Lake Huron, that's a call event, so we can catch and call all day long. It takes the edge off of, you know, just keep throwing them in the box.
Yeah.
And so that makes it way more enjoyable. And then when you know you're in the right area like that and you're catching good fish, and, it's those are the days we all dream about as tournament guys that are doing this. It's those days.
TKI CNC produces reliable, meticulously crafted marine components for every fishing adventure. Check out a complete listing of products at TKICNC.com. There you'll find lots of things, including the multi-purpose rod holders and their forward sonar pole mounting kits. These product designs specifically maximize your efficiency and reliability in the boat. This is why so many hardcore anglers, including tournament anglers, are turning to TKI to accessorize their boats. For a detailed look or in-depth tutorials, check them out on YouTube, Facebook, or Instagram at TKICNC. We're all looking to have the ultimate edge on the water, but how do we get there? When it comes to fishing rods, JT Outdoor Products has you covered. Their technique-specific rods are engineered and tested by tournament professionals to give you the competitive advantage on the tournament trail or the extra edge to the passionate everyday angler. They're hand-built in Farmington, Minnesota. With the highest grade carbon fiber blanks and the finest componentry, JT rods are ultra lightweight, incredibly sensitive, and built for performance. Whether you're after walleye, bass, pike, or panfish, they have every species covered. Their rods deliver precision, durability, and unmatched feel. Don't settle for ordinary. Fish smarter with JT Outdoor Products, where performance meets perfection. Visit them at jtodp.com. That link is in the description of this podcast. Do yourself a favor, check them out today. Devil's Lake is one of North Dakota's premier outdoor recreational destinations. And to find out more about what the lake and the community of Devil's Lake has to offer, head to devilslakend.com and get all that. We're talking about the lodging and restaurant options and just the lay of the land and everything going on in the community. There's all kinds of stuff all summer long going on in and around the community of Devil's Lake. That link is in the description. Curious how the fish were setting up out there. You know, it's a big Great Lake. It's a big expanse of water, but you're also talking about structure and kind of fine tuning, where you were finding these fish. Like, how did that look? Like, for a tourney grade fish, were you seeing schools of, two, three, four or more, or was it a school of fish with one big one in it, or were the big ones just by themselves? I'm curious how that was sort of setting up for you and how that sort of factored into how you fished,
Yeah, I mean, it was a mixed bag up there. There was fish that we caught that were individuals by themselves. The thing about the area I was in is they were mixed right with the big sheephead, and big sheephead, big walleyes, big smallmouths, they all go hand in hand, and they all like the same stuff. So if you find in big sheephead, don't drive away from them is, I guess, a quick little tidbit there is to kind of look around some more. But to decipher a sheephead from a walleye on LiveScope is, for me, it's pretty easy. I mean, obviously sheephead are much more round and thick than a walleye is, long and slender. So that's exactly what you see on LiveScope is that big round hot air balloon, I call it. That's 99% going to be a sheephead if you're around them. You're looking for that little slimmer, bright signal. Still going to be long, but it's going to be much slimmer. And those are your walleyes. And when you see them chase baits, especially baits that are going to the bottom and they follow them down, that's when you can really tell what it is when they're actually chasing it down. It gives you a full side profile of that fish, and you get a really good idea. But yeah, I mean, we had singles that turned out to be big fish. It was not as easy to catch those that were singles because they have no competition when they're by themselves. It's the ones that you could find in schools that were pretty easy to catch. If you could find a 6-pack or an 8-pack and get one or two or five to chase it, now you got competition and somebody's going to get your bait. It's just that simple. But the problem was, once you caught that one fish, good luck trying to get on that school again. They're extremely smart. Most of the time they would go belly to the bottom after all that ruckus of fighting the fish, and you would never see the rest of those fish again. So you just put the trolling motor back on and start looking for the next one. But yeah, we had a mixed bag of singles and schools out there.
Is Huron, like those fish, is it is it ultimately just that gin clear water that makes those fish as challenging as they are? Or is there just a lot more factors? Is there a lot of fishing pressure out there? Like, are these fish seeing a lot of baits? I'm sort of curious how that is.
Yeah, not much for fishing pressure at all there. Very few local people venture out onto the big lake. Most of them will stay right inside Thunder Bay, right by Alpena. So when you get out to the big pond, you've got a lot of it to yourself. The problem is that clear water. I had very few that I caught, I would say within 65 feet of the boat.
That's crazy.
I was targeting, I had my scope set at 120 feet. Probably should have set it further. But I was set at 120 looking, and when I'd get them at 100, I'd start casting to them. And trying to get an accurate cast out at 100 feet is not the easiest thing, but the more and more and more you do it, it becomes second nature. And if you could get a fish to see your bait at 100, watch it, follow it, you could almost get that fish every time, but they weren't quite that easy. They'd follow it to the bottom. You'd start your cadence with your jig and plastic, and occasionally I would swing back to see my target to see if he was still following. I try and keep the scope off the fish because if I know he's on it, I don't need to shine him anymore. Just keep the beam off of him. Just one less thing to worry about. But I would occasionally check it, knowing, oh, yeah, he's still following it. You can see the little fuzzy stuff coming along the bottom. Keep the cadence coming. And you might have to do this for 15, 20 seconds, and then finally he commits and eats it. But, it was not easy, and it's due to that clear water. It's just, they can see better. They know we're there. They can see your bait. They understand that it's probably not the real thing.
Yeah.
And it's challenging. But boy, is it fun once you catch them.
Oh yeah. And so to get six bites either day, how many fish do you feel like you had to cast at?
I would say I probably threw at on average 75 fish a day.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. You were busy.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
I mean. Yeah, it was tough. I chased a few schools. So another thing is that those fish on Huron constantly moving. None of them just sit there and wait for you to cast at them. So it's like trying to shoot a pheasant underwater. You're casting ahead of them, trying to land your jig and let it swing down to them as they're moving, and then you got to deal with the boat waves and the waves and boat control and keeping the scope beam at them. It's mentally draining by the end of the day, but those fish move like crazy.
Well, I haven't specifically asked you about conditions, so, kind of, this might be like the last big question, to kind of describe the tournament, but, what were the conditions like weather conditions, and then also to sort of lump it in together here at once, like, what were the challenges, if any, that the conditions and or the weather sort of provided for the tournament, and maybe not just on tournament day, but pre-fishing, like what were some of those discussions? Like, right. I'm sort of curious, conditions, big picture for this tournament.
Yeah, huge, huge issue with conditions. When you're in clear water like that, you need some kind of wind, but obviously you don't want too much, because then you can't move around, you can't check areas that you want to go look at, because it's just going to take too long to get there and back, and then you're trying to fight the waves with live scope and keep your beam going the right direction while the boat's going the other direction. And it's just a challenge. But day one, we had what I consider ideal conditions, which was very light and variable winds. So we had a little chop on the water, but I was able to drive 50 miles an hour all the way up to my spot. And just enough wind to break up the surface of the water, but it super easy for live scoping. Boat control is not an issue. You can, the boat splashing and making all kinds of noise is not an issue. And that's why you saw good weights on day one. It's because it was ideal conditions for doing whatever you wanted. But I knew day two would be a huge turnaround for most guys, including, well, I shouldn't say including myself. I had the bites, but We had a great morning drive. Still was able to go dang near wide open. And the wind was predicted to blow at 11 o'clock. So that was going to change a lot of things midday. And hard out of the southeast, which did exactly that. 11 o'clock comes and here comes the wind. I was a little protected in the area I was fishing with that southeast wind. I was kind of wrapped around a corner and protected. Still had plenty of waves, but that changed a lot of guys' bites, you know, going from pretty calm in the morning to all of a sudden blowing 20, 25 out of the southeast. And sure enough, you know, the weights were down the second day. And, you know, I was surprised when I weighed 20 and I only moved down three spots. It was pretty evident that everybody kind of had a tougher day overall.
No, I like the clarification on that too, because it's, you know, yeah, if you're not, like, if I'm only paying attention to a few people, or, you know, if you're listening to the live stream, it's like everybody's kind of repeating themselves coming across the stage. It's like, I like the description that's a little bit more detailed from you being there, because, you don't know, I mean, it just kind of makes a little bit of sense. And those things all factor into the fishing, you know.
Sure do.
You know, a lot of guys talk about, you know, or just how you speak on it. Like, in some cases, you know, if you're just speaking on the fishing, you know, like you're saying, the conditions were perfect for live scoping. But if you're a tournament angler, and you're one that has really helped me embrace this, you know, for you tournament anglers, like, you know, in a past conversation with you, you're talking about, mm-hmm. talking about fishing in the wind, like, so a lot of tournament anglers kind of hope for tough weather in terms of fishing, because
right.
that, from a competitive standpoint, it's an opportunity for you to do well. If you're on the right bite and you're in the right area and you're doing the right thing, tough weather is going to make it harder for a lot of other people. And that can help you, you know. But yeah, so there's like, that's like a, it's like a two-sided coin to that conversation,
sure,
right? So like, yeah, and it's almost like in this tournament, the exact thing happened. It's like you had your really good day, which was good for you because you were on a great program.
Yeah.
And then day two, it was tougher, and you know, you weighed less weight, which is less desirable. But that tough weather or tough conditions sort of came to fruition from a competitive standpoint, because it was even tougher, you know, as it would seem for so many others, you know. So it kind of like, you kind of experienced both in one tournament. On a 2-day tournament, it's like you got to take advantage of a really good day, and then you got to take advantage of it being really, really hard for everybody.
That's the thing. Yeah, I knew going into it that day one I was gonna have to catch them pretty good, because things were ideal. Like, you couldn't have drawn up a better day to have a tournament on Lake Huron, and I was lucky enough to catch them and be in third. But you know, just that second day, you know, I had a great feeling going into it. Like, I think I got a real legit chance to win this thing. And,
oh yeah,
you know, thank God Isaac won this thing by a landslide, because, you know, had I caught that big fish at the end of the day that came off, you know, I would have came in thinking, oh, I got a shot at it, because I would have legitimately had another 27, 28 pounds in the box.
Mm-hmm.
And thank God Isaac blew it away, so I didn't have to feel so bad about that.
Fair enough,
but,
yeah.
You know, even so, I mean, second place versus sixth is, it's a pretty big difference in money. But yeah, overall happy with the tournament.
There's another question that I feel like somebody like you that's been in the tournament game for a while, it's sort of a worthwhile talking point of, like, you know, talking about the challenges of fishing in tournaments these days. It's like, you know, I feel like I ask a lot of tournament guys, it's like, what were the challenges, you know? And it's usually a fishing related answer, like, oh, the weather or the cold fronts or whatever. I feel like this year I haven't really been having that conversation very much, because all these river tournaments, like with all the kind of the, you know, the weird boat draws and it's not mm-hmm. always, the challenges aren't always a fishing answer. Sometimes it's different. Sometimes it's a different competition. Is there anything worthwhile there for this season for you? Do you feel like some of the adversity or some of the hurdles from a fishing perspective that have sort of kept you from the finishes you were looking for? Like, is there like a worthwhile talker there? Like, you know, just talking about the challenges this season so far.
Yeah. I mean, most people don't even realize all that goes into it as far as the tournament finish goes. You just see the end result, but you have no idea what actually took place, you know, boat number, when you're on a river system, your boat number, if you've got a key spot to go to, it can make or break your tournament. You could literally finish first or finish 75th. And I've done it before. I've won Red Wing when I had a great boat number, knowing I had a winning spot, and it paid off and won it. But I've been on the other end of that too, where, you know, just take, for example, the cross this year on day two. You know, there's Shimoda sitting on the spot I wanted to fish on day two, and he was the tournament leader, and Danny Paltz was right there as well, and then I just gave them their space. And, you know, had I had that spot to myself, I would have easily took a top 10 out of there. Mm-hmm. But as it turned out, I'm 17th, just trying to pick up scraps off to the side.
That's still a check, though. I mean, that's still a check.
Yeah, like, no, it was great. I mean, day one, I had a good boat number, and I ran up to 7, first guy in the lock. Got to my wing dam that I wanted, was able to decipher it where I wanted to start on it, either on the end, in the middle, or towards shore, just based on current at that given time. Nailed it first shot, landed right on the fish, first cast, 19-incher. Caught 20 keepers in the first 45 minutes. I mean, it was ideal. But then, you know, day two, it was, you know, there's a lock in the barge in the lock. Couldn't go back up to 7. Probably wouldn't have got my spot anyway because I was a late boat number. You know, just run down to 8. There's Bill Shimoda. It's like,
yeah,
you know, there's so many things that go into it. And, you know, that's just boat numbers. Then you talk about weather and, you know, I could talk for hours on finishes I've had due to weather, be it good or bad. You know, just, you know, I'll go back to the 2000 RCL Championship, the very first one they ever had. I was leading that event out of Green Bay, catching these fish on a little rock pile out from O'Connell, coming out of Metro Park in Green Bay. It's about a 32-33 mile run. And was leading that tournament after 2 days on that rock pile, and then never got to go back to it for day 3 or 4 because they restricted us to the river, Box River, due to wind. And, you know, it still haunts me because that was a $400,000 event. And, you know, it's just like, why? You know, why does the weather have to be a factor?
Yeah. And it's rarely... it's rarely a factor for the good, or at least we'll almost never like remember it that way. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, dude. Gosh. So many things.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's exactly the reason I like to, you know, ask that question to somebody that's a little bit more of a seasoned veteran. And I like, cause it builds context, even all the tournament podcasts that I do. I just hope that people will listen to this one and hear that again. It helps me, and it helps, you know, kind of give credibility to a lot of these conversations that I have of, like, you know, there's certain situations where we're probably not giving respect where it's due to certain people putting together certain things in tournaments. And then in other scenarios, you know, you sometimes, if it's not said out loud, like, you gotta realize maybe your good boat draw, maybe it was just a roll of the dice at the rules meeting that really ended up being a big, big, big factor, or it almost always does. To the in a river tournament, it's almost like the boat draw is like a major factor. Now, you still got to go out, even if you have a tough day one boat draw, or if you're a mid pack boat draw, or you're going to be in the middle of the pack boat day, you still have to go out and compete and try to win.
Yeah.
But man, it's like there's like a weird handicap there. But anyways, and it's not my prerogative to like dwell on that. But that does, as I said, like that does give a lot of context and kind of credibility to other conversations that I have, including this one of, like, you know, having somebody like you talk about that, that's a thing.
Yeah, and just like the weather too. I mean, most times the weather hurts you than helps you. And
yeah,
I can't even tell you how many. I know I should have 2 more championship wins under my belt, but weather dictated otherwise, and there's just nothing you could do about it. You try and adapt, you know, but sometimes you just don't have the time to figure it out after everything changes. And, yeah, I've been through that gamut way too many times. You know, even just fishing with co-anglers, you know, if you get, you know, for example, like here on day one, I had a great co-angler, Garrett, in the back of my boat, and And he caught a 28-incher for me out of the back of the boat.
Oh, man.
Like, you know, how nice is that to have occasionally?
Yeah.
And it happens rarely, but good God. You know, I was actually looking at two fish up in the bow, and he was looking out the back with the LiveScope shuttle, and he's like, I got a big mark back here. I said, catch that thing. I said, I'm looking at two of them up here, and it wasn't 10 seconds later. He said, I got them, and sure enough, 9-pounder.
You had a good moment then with Garrett.
That's
cool.
That was a great moment. Yeah,
that's cool,
great
man. Time. Now, talking about conditions and changing, do you feel like, and this might even end up being like super specific if there is one or not at all, but do you feel like there are certain patterns, maybe certain times of year on certain bodies of water? Are there some patterns that are really so susceptible to changing conditions that from a tournament perspective, you wouldn't even look for? Like I'm thinking like a shallow weed bite on such and such a lake. Or are there some, you know, looking for these deeper summer patterns on the Great Lakes? Like, are there certain bites that just make the most sense from a tournament perspective because they're a little bit more reliable and less susceptible? Is there like a conversation there? I'll be curious to hear about that.
Yeah, 100%. It's especially kind of Great Lakes, or if you're fishing structure, and I'll use Green Bay as an example because I probably fish there the most, but it is so weather dependent. It is almost all weather dependent. I mean, there's areas that you could beat your brains in for 4 days on the best spot on the lake, what I consider one of the best spots, and you will not get a bite. But if that weather switches and the wind turns to a certain direction, you better be there. And it could last 12 hours. It could last 24 hours. It could last 6 hours. You just don't know. But it is so weather dependent, it's ridiculous. You know, the wind blows the wrong way for X number of hours, and it'll completely change your area, like, quick. And those fish are gone. That just comes down to like local knowledge. If you know these areas and when they're good and when they're not, that's kind of the whole process. And, you know, us as tournament guys, that's our job, is to kind of figure out what wind is this particular area like, or what conditions, cloudy, sunny. You have to just keep putting the pieces together year after year after year after year. And, you know, eventually you get kind of a good idea of what you need to be doing. But yeah, weather it's dictates so much of what we do.
But you know, this, so to speak, like a little bit of an arms race out to these suspended fish now that we have forward sonar. Where does that fit into all this? Is that a reliable bite that you guys are trying to find everywhere? You know, and I'm only just envisioning this because suspended fish they're easier to see on that sonar. They don't hide in the rocks. They don't hide in the weeds. Like other patterns might be tougher to put together. Like, is there something to that where you're, or a way to describe that, it's really just something that is a little bit more reliable to figure out and find you know?
Yeah. It's not very easy to do. It's easy to do if you land on them, right? If you put this trolling motor in the water and they're out in front of you suspended, yeah, no problem catching them or figuring out what they want to eat. But the problem lies in, yeah, you go back there tomorrow and they're not on your screen anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
Now
yeah.
You need to figure out which way they go, north, south, east, west. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, my rule of thumb, and it's been for many, 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 many years, way back to the early 2000s, is if they're not there on day two, you always want to go downwind from where they were the day before. Start looking downwind, and it only makes sense because the wind dictates everything, and the bait fish will move downwind with the currents and the waves, and then the big fish will follow. And if they go far enough, they're gonna end up towards a windy shoreline somewhere, which we all know windy shorelines are great when it's blowing into them, but it can change overnight and be zero fish there the next day. So yeah, that's, you know, suspended game is cool. It's fun to do. But the problem lies in just trying to stay with those fish. That's the hard part.
All right. Maybe this is the final. Man, I can't talk to you without giving you some props, Dad. Your boy is just killing it. It's just so fun. It's been so fun to watch bass fishing For me anyways, I've just really enjoyed that. And it's just so cool, you know, to see your boy there just doing really, really well. And so I would say this would be my question. What, I mean, with his experience, you guys are probably having some pretty healthy fishing conversations, you know, and tournament conversations. What would be, you know, what is one thing, you know, in recent history that you feel like you've offered him as like a good piece of advice? And maybe what's a nugget of something, a skill that, that maybe you've picked up from him that is like an interesting thing?
Yeah, it's kind of a two parts to that question. I mean, obviously Jay's killing it this year, especially still leading Angler of the Year, and he's heading up north here in a few weeks to finish out his season. But we honestly don't talk much about fishing tournament wise. I can't talk to him about things due to the rules of Bassmaster. So we got to make sure we're, you know, on the up and up with that. And you know, what I talk to him a lot about is just kind of the mental part of the game. That's first and foremost, because, you know, it's easy to get spun out. It's easy to listen to other guys in the tournament talk at the dock and all that stuff. And the very first thing I think I kind of, when he joined the Bassmaster Elite Series, I was down in Florida to watch him fish his first event. And you know, going into it, I'm like, you do realize, you know, you're going to be starstruck when you put your boat in the water that first morning and you're going to see all these guys. I said, but when you leave that dock, you know, that's your time. It's you against five bass that day. It's not against Gerald Swindle. It's not against any of these guys that have been doing it for years. You're on your own at that point. You were fishing for five fish, and that's it. That's your job. Just do your job. That's all I ever tell him. And, you know, so his mental game is really good. Mm-hmm. He doesn't get flustered. He doesn't spin out if it's not happening. Just understanding, you know, where you need to be, what you need to be doing. He's learned all that through the years of fishing in a lot of tournaments. He's fished way more tournaments than people even realize. He's constantly fishing. So, but yeah, you know, I'm there for the mental part of it. His Angler of the Year deal it's on his brain, of course. I've been lucky enough to win two of them. Had an opportunity at about five of them in my career that I thought I had a legit chance. Only took two of them home. Just talking him through that thing, you know, trying to get his mindset right on how to deal with it. That's my job. I appreciate the props. He's his own man now. He is taking his own career and running with it, and I'm unbelievably proud of that guy and what he's done so far in his short career.
Oh yeah, dude. It is super special to see. But he's kind of a savage with the forward sonar deal. I mean, you know, if you wouldn't admit maybe he jumped in the first time you got it in your boat, was helping you with some settings or anything like that?
You know, not really. I mean, when we first started, we kind of started at the same time, obviously, looking at forward sonar. He kind of took it to the next level to, you know, understand the different settings, different forward mode versus perspective, you know, when is one better versus the other, you know, just, you know, he picked up on things that I wasn't seeing when we were together, and he would point them out to me, and I'm like, okay, I missed that, you know, I didn't see that, and just kind of bouncing things off each other. But most of that stuff just comes down to using it over and over and over and over and over again in all the different situations, be it on the Mississippi River or you're using it on Lake Huron, and you know, you need to know the differences and, you know, take advantage of all of it. So he's done really, really well with it. He's very efficient, very efficient.
Yeah, dude, it's fun to watch those guys, like, you know, he and his colleagues, you know, I mean, those bass guys, it's like they fish in like an Elite Series tournament a week, it seems like, for 6 months. It's like, you know, if you just count the highest level tournaments, like you said, you know, you walleye guys. And I had this actually written down too. Again, I'm trying to not to take your whole day up, but like, are you pretty much stuck to the NWT schedule this year? Or did you have anything outside the NWT this year?
No, I'm just doing NWT this year. You know, just filming a couple shows for The Next Bite, and then actually took a little part-time gig. My other son that nobody really knows about because of Jay's taking all the interviews and stuff, but Jackson's Jay's younger brother. He's 23. He's in the golf world, and he's a full-time caddy. He does 6 months in Florida and then 6 months up here, and I'm actually part-time caddying with him at a big Sand Valley resort here in Wisconsin this summer. So
yeah,
I do 2-3 days a week, you know, when I'm home and have time, and you know, go walk 7-8 miles carrying 2 bags a day, and you know, it just keeps me in shape and, you know, keeps me moving, and I get to spend time with him too. So yeah, that's my world. I love golfing, I love fishing, and then when that's all done, I deer hunt and then try and keep going for the next year.
Dude, that is awesome, man. That's the dream. Spending time with your boys and seeing them having success and loving their lives and loving what they're doing. And you get to kind of be there and dude, that is
do it with
so
them
awesome.
It's a cool thing. And wish me luck. Both of them are getting married in 2026. So that'll be interesting. Jackson's getting married down in Florida in January. And then Jay's going to get married in October here up in Wisconsin. So.
And Jay Fish's tournament's down in Florida too. Like that's gotta be, it's probably not so simple, but opportunity for little family reunions. Kind of funny being from Wisconsin and it's like Florida's kind of like a gathering place for the Shakirits, man. That's cool.
Yeah, that's what happened last year at Okeechobee. Jay fished that tournament, and Jackson and his fiance drove over and got to see him at the weigh-ins and talk and hang out, have dinner, that kind of stuff. So, a
couple of Packers fans down in Florida.
Well, no. Jay's actually a Chicago Bear fan of all things.
No way! Oh, so you did. So you don't have a perfect record, Dad.
No,
you had one slip through the cracks.
Yeah, he one of his aunts when he was a young kid. He got a bunch of bear stuff from his aunt, and she like Mike Ditka autograph stuff, and she gave it to him, and he was a Bears fan ever since then. He was only like 4 years old, and you know, it's funny because we have the rivalry up here and Bear Packers rivalry,
huge.
You know, this is the year. Jay keeps telling me this is the year. Well, we'll see.
Yeah, you haven't had to be worried for a little while.
No,
that's pretty silly, though. That's pretty
awesome. It's probably a good thing he was a Bears fan, because he would sit here, watch the Sunday noon game. The Bears would be down by 20 at halftime. He'd get super mad. He'd walk out of the house, go down to the pond, and just fish the rest of the day. He wouldn't even bother watching the rest. So,
being a Bears fan drove him to a phenomenal
him to a career in fishing, yeah, for sure.
That's probably been stated before. You guys have probably figured that out long ago, but that's hilarious for me to hear. That is awesome, man. Dude, all right, cool, man. Well, Jason, I appreciate all the stories, man. If there's anything else that we should be digging into, but I love all that, you know, the meaty context of like what it was like out there in Huron and, you know, the conditions, and just kind of helping wrap my head around that, and the clarification on, you know, guys that were fishing, you know, everybody was bragging about how they fished a half mile from takeoff. And then there was, you know, the same merit badge to the guys that drove 100 miles. I was like, how do I put that together? It's like, is there only two rock humps in the entire lake that hold fish? Like what's going on? But, you know, phenomenal to hear kind of your story where you kind of put two and two together, didn't get bogged down in all that. And, you know, you went up north and found your own deal that was the right deal. And you, you know, you could, yeah. And, yeah, all good stuff, man. And
Yeah, that's just part of the game, putting it all together. You know, nowadays, trying to get away from people is the deal. And, you know, it's funny, we fish through St. Marie event and guys run down to Alpena. And now we fish Alpena and guys run up to Sault Ste. Marie. But it's all about getting away from guys, having the fish to yourself, managing the school. And that's how you win. You know, it's just that way.
Right on. I appreciate it, man. I'll let you go for real.
All right. Yep. Appreciate the interview. We'll talk to you.